From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, an African-American writer researches her family tree, investigates the white branch she knew little about, and discovers she has to revise some of her thinking about herself. We talk with journalist, novelist, librettist, and poet Tulani Davis. Her new memoir is called My Confederate Kinfolk. Also, some laughs from British comic writer and producer Steve Coogan. On his BBC series, he played Alan Partridge, an annoying and clueless TV talk show host who, after losing his show, becomes an annoying and clueless radio DJ. He starred in the movies 24-Hour Party People and Happy Endings. Coogan is now starring in the new film Tristram Shandy, A Cock and Bull Story. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After writing for many years about African American history and contemporary life, Tulani Davis has written a book tracing her family tree. On that tree, she found her white great-grandfather and his older brother who fought with the Confederate Army. She says by the time the book was done, she had to revise some of her thinking about herself. Davis grew up in the 1950s. Her book, 1959, is an autobiographical novel about integrating a white school. She wrote the librettos for operas about Malcolm X and the slave ship Amistad. And for many years, she wrote for the Village Voice. Her new memoir is called My Confederate Kinfolk, A 21st Century Freed Woman Discovers Her Roots. Before you started this book, did you know that you had white members of the family tree?
Yes, I knew I had a white great-grandfather, which of course means there were others, but I have to say I really never thought about it. It was pretty common where I grew up for people to know that they had some white ancestry, and people rarely ever mentioned names or talked about looking for who those people were.
And just in terms of like personal identity, how important was it to you before you started researching this book to know who was part of that white family that was part of your family tree? Did you care?
No, I didn't care. There was a sense that you knew what the story was because the story was a cliche. In other words, everybody in the town who had white ancestry, we all pretty much assumed we had the same story, which was a plantation master who had forced himself upon someone in the quarter, or in the case of my furthest back Davis ancestor, a woman who was raped on the slave ship. So it was as if you knew the story. And in fact, that was quite wrong. The story I found was much more interesting.
What got you started in this direction of researching your family tree was a book that your grandmother had been writing when she died. She died in 1971. What was this book, and what did it do to spark your interest?
She wanted to write a novel. She was scared to write the story as a true story. She wanted to write a novel about her parents. I wasn't initially fascinated with it myself. In that she didn't tell me about it, so I didn't get a chance to talk to her about it. It was something that came to me after she died. But I had been asked to work on a Broadway show on Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. And in doing the treatment for that book and talking with people on that team for that show, I suddenly blurted out one day, well, I have my own Sally Hemings story, and I've been trying to use that to write this script, and I've found that it's difficult. I found it's taking me into some places I've never been, just psychologically, I guess, or emotionally. And it was quite a revelation to me when I said it, because I had assumed, like I said, that I understood what that story was. I didn't think I had deep feelings about it, and suddenly, in wrestling with that, one of the people on the team said, you should really write about that. And then I sort of went back and started looking at my grandmother's notes and trying to understand what was the story she was trying to tell, because she had a lot of feelings about it. And to her, it was a romance. So I found I couldn't quite buy into that. But I went to dig up what it was she had written, to look up the facts behind the notes she had for her memoir.
Let's talk about some of the things that you learned about your great-grandparents on your mother's side. Your great-grandmother was named Chloe Curry. She was a former slave from Alabama. Your great-grandfather was Will Campbell. He was a white man from Missouri. How did these two people meet?
Chloe Curry, who had married in Alabama just after she got out of slavery in 1865, had decided that it would be great if she and her husband moved to Mississippi. They had to leave four children in Alabama to do that, but they came out to Mississippi because there was better work, better paying work, and less violence, really, directed towards African Americans at that moment. They came to work for Will Campbell's older brother, whose name was Leonidas Campbell, and he was head of the farm there in Yazoo County in Mississippi. In 1875 or so, they arrived at that farm.
So she was married when she got there. How did she end up being with your great-grandfather, Will Campbell, a white man?
Her husband left. He hated Mississippi, but I think whatever situation arose, at some point, I should back up and say, at some point, Chloe was hired to work for Will as his housekeeper. And whatever friendship or situation that arose between them, and I don't know how it got started, but whatever alliance arose between Will and Chloe caused Jim Curry to go back to Alabama, and they later divorced.
Now, when your grandmother was writing a novel based on your great-grandparents' lives, she was writing a romance. Did you see your great-grandparents' relationship as being romantic or more practical? Do you have a sense of what they meant to each other? I mean, this was a relationship that society would have scorned and, you know, wasn't even legal. And as you pointed out earlier, a lot of relationships between black women and white men in that period were power relationships. The men would rape the women or just kind of coerce them into being a mistress. So what was the nature of this relationship?
I guess I have to say I'm not sure what the origin was, and it could have arisen out of his power over her as employer. He could have taken advantage of her. I believe the relationship, because it lasted so long, which was at least 20 years, at a time when both people had a choice about that, I believe the relationship really must have had a strong basis in friendship, in commonality, and in many ways I see them as similar kinds of people. They kept their own counsel, seemingly. They weren't afraid of being isolated, which they certainly were, particularly as a couple. But even previous to that, each of them had suffered quite a bit of hardship through the Civil War. And I think they both had a common respect and admiration for hard work, for people who worked hard, and real love for cotton farming and the Delta, the Mississippi landscape. And I imagine because he taught her so much about the business end of raising cotton that there was a kind of focus on the day-to-day, and that he also shared with her really a lot of the information that a newly freed person would need to know about their rights as a citizen in America, about how banking worked, about how education took place, and there were so many things that indicate friendship to me and generosity from Will towards Chloe that I really think there was at least a great companionship.
Did your great-grandparents live as husband and wife, even though they couldn't legally marry because of the miscegenation laws? Did they live as husband and wife? And did your grandmother, you know, grow up with both parents in the house?
Yes. They lived actually in what I would think is a relatively small house, actually, one-bedroom home. My grandmother grew up with two parents until her father died when she was about 20.
Do you think your great-grandparents were attacked by any of their neighbors or, just shut out by their neighbors because they were basically living together in a socially scorned way? They were a black woman and a white man living together as husband and wife. I mean, that was against
right.
the law.
Right. There were a few other cases of it in that county. I'm quite certain they were shunned for it. I'm quite certain they didn't have company visiting, and that if company came to visit, well, that there was some pretense that she was just the cook and did not live there. It would have required a lot of that. When he died, Chloe could not attend his funeral without offending everyone in town, so she stayed home.
My guest is Tulani Davis. Her new memoir is called My Confederate Kinfolk. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tulani Davis. Her new book, My Confederate Kinfolk, is about researching her family tree and discovering the story of her white great-grandfather and his family. So it sounds like your great-grandfather, Will Campbell, was a pretty decent guy. I imagine you don't feel so positively about his brother, Leonidas Campbell. He was elected to the State House from Yazoo, Mississippi in 1875. And he was elected to replace James Patterson, who had been lynched. Was your great-grandfather's brother connected to that lynching?
Yes, he was. Leonidas Campbell called a posse out to his farm who strung up James Patterson in Leonidas's front yard. And I was really actually very shocked when I first discovered it. I didn't know all that much about Leonidas, and I later discovered he also participated in a massacre during the Civil War, a massacre of black soldiers. So, yes, he was a bit much for me to deal with. I had to really try to understand who that man was, and I knew also that Chloe disliked him, so the more I found out about him, the more I began to understand her position. It must have been difficult to work for someone who had just allowed a lynching in his front yard at the time that, you know, you start working for him.
Now, your great-grandfather's brother was elected to the State House from Yazoo, Mississippi in 1875. Were blacks allowed to vote in that election?
Well, they had voted three times, men only. They had voted in 1868 and I guess most recently in 1873. They certainly were expected to vote. They were the voting majority because really they outnumbered white people in the county. They had elected James Patterson to the State House of Representatives. When he was killed, he was in the State House. He was a school teacher, and he also lived on the Campbell farm. So his death actually made it possible for Leonidas Campbell to be elected to the State House. No black people voted that year or for the next 90 years. And so he had an easy time, whereas Patterson would have been a shoo-in had he lived and had black people not been terrorized from voting that year.
So when you look at your family tree now, the white side and the African-American side, do you feel like you're looking at American history and you're looking at both sides of the Civil War? Do you feel like there are certain touchstones of American history that you can see and sharp focus in your own family?
Oh, yes. I have two thoughts about that. One, that a lot of our family trees must be like this, that those things we learned about in school may actually be reflected in all these cousins we don't know we have, and that that is the American family, or it's how American society is made. Some of us were, just as there were families that were divided by the Civil War, like the Campbells had one brother who was a Union supporter and the rest were Confederate supporters. But the family's actually larger and it's black and white. So I have a black ancestor who was a former slave who became a minister and was at the black conventions in the 1880s trying to fight for the right of blacks to vote and to continue to participate in electoral politics. And as you said, I have a great uncle who was part of the overthrow of Reconstruction, who thought that was the worst thing possible for his interest. And I hadn't, as I said at the beginning of the interview, I hadn't really thought about it before, but it seems really natural to me now. It seems logical, as it does, that I am an outgrowth of both of these people, that I'm sort of some, it feels logical that I'm one of the outcomes of all their actions.
Now, I should say that you found certain things that you felt very connected to in the white part of your family tree, such as the fact that a couple of the women in that family tree were would-be writers. You're a writer. One of them actually started theaters, and you've written for the theater. So in a way, I mean, you must feel very connected to them, even though it's the white part of your family.
I do. It's odd to suddenly feel connected at 56, but when I first got some newspaper clippings in the mail with pictures of them, I went, oh, my God, it's my hairline. It's my raccoon eyes. And that really shocked me. I wasn't ready for that. It almost scared me. I just thought, oh, I'm not ready for new information. And when I found all these women were writers and some of them never got a publishing company to publish their fiction or poetry, I said to myself, well, I really don't have that among the Davises. This is really a new thought, that I have this connection to other family members who, like many women, I guess, of the 19th and early 20th century, were trying to write, partly because they'd been through such incredible experiences. And those women are very unique, very interesting, and they have a lot of other qualities, I think, that I have.
You mentioned looking at relatives in the white part of your family tree and then seeing some of their facial characteristics in your own face when you look in the mirror. You're somebody who's written extensively about African-American issues and poetry and music, African-American history, African-American identity. So what did it do to your own sense of identity as an African-American to start to see the facial characteristics of white people who you didn't even realize until recently were in your family tree?
I have to say, at first, I don't think I digested it at all. I was really stunned by it, to the point of maybe not knowing what my reaction was. It was just really new for me, and I did not refer to them as relatives of mine for a long time. I referred to them by name. I wouldn't have said Leonidas was my great uncle. It took me 3 years to be able to do that, because people I'd known about my whole life were my family. You know, my great grandfather, William Roscoe Davis. I call him my great grandfather, but it took some time for me to begin to say, well, these people are relatives of mine, because I found them interesting as people. I'm not sure I would have liked them all, but I would love to have met them all. And at the same time, I met some living members of the Campbell family who have all been wonderful to me and were more like people I would know anyway. So that helped me to bridge the gap a little bit. And I do feel like it's going to be easy to be cousins with the living Campbells, but it was a big adjustment.
Do you think of your great-grandparents as being progressive rebels because they had this long-lasting relationship together in spite of how society scorned such relationships?
Yes, I do think they were rebels. I also think, and this I take to heart a bit, that they followed their own star. They believed in doing what they wanted to do, and they weren't concerned with convention, and that they made a way for themselves to do as they wanted to do. And that's very important. It takes a lot of guts, and I feel glad to know that story, because it empowers me to to walk my own path.
Well, you're in your 50s, and you've kind of already been walking your own path, don't you think?
Yeah, but these are hard times to stand up and be different, I think. We're in a time where convention's very important, and I think it is, as opposed to the 60s when I came of age, when it was important perhaps not to be conventional. But I think it is empowering to know that people who went before you really were trying as well, that you really aren't reinventing the wheel as you go through your life, that people have tried to make it possible for you to do those things that you do, whether you knew about it or not. I think when you do find it out, it feels more like you have an obligation almost to honor that, to continue to honor it. Perhaps in my case, to continue to honor it. But I actually did feel greatly empowered by both of them, but particularly by Chloe. I feel much more like I should go forward more fiercely.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tilani Davis is the author of the new book, My Confederate Kinfolk. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Franz Kafka's Metamorphoses, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and from Diane Wolfe of New York and Washington, D.C., in great appreciation of NPR's mission to create a more informed public. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, comic and actor Steve Coogan does some uncanny impressions and talks about Alan Partridge, the annoying TV talk show host and radio DJ that he played on the BBC. Coogan is starring in the new movie, Tristram Shandy, A Cock and Bull Story. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Groucho Marx once said that the trouble with writing a book about yourself is you can't fool around. Why not? People fool around with themselves all the time. I'm Tristram Shandy, the main character in this story, the leading role.
That's Steve Coogan in the new movie Tristram Shandy, A Cock and Bull Story. It's a movie about making a film adaptation of the virtually unfilmable 18th century comic novel Tristram Shandy. The movie alternates between scenes from Tristram Shandy and scenes on the film set. Coogan plays himself, as well as Tristram Shandy and Shandy's father. The new film is directed by Michael Winterbottom, who also directed Coogan in 24-Hour Party People. Coogan was featured in Jim Jarmusch's movie Coffee and Cigarettes and co-starred in Happy Endings. In England, he's well known for his alter ego Alan Partridge, the self-absorbed and clueless TV talk show host and radio DJ that Coogan played on BBC TV. You can see reruns on BBC America. Tristram Shandy will be opening gradually in theaters around the country starting at the end of the month. Steve Coogan, welcome to Fresh Air. Does it mess with your mind to be playing a version of yourself that isn't quite yourself, knowing that when we viewers watch it, we might think that that is really you?
I don't mind. I kind of like playing with, I like blurring the edges of fact and fiction sometimes. It's more fun. I know some people... The important thing to me was that it was not self-indulgent narcissism, that the parts of the story that feature me playing myself help people understand the essence of the novel within the film. So it was important to me that people didn't think, why the hell are we watching this movie about an actor we've never heard of? And also just there's something interesting about, for those people who do know me or become aware of when they're watching the film, that they're watching an actor playing himself, is how much of it is real and how much of it is not. And so it's kind of, there's a double bluff going on. If you play yourself in an unsympathetic way and you're allowing that to happen, that somehow you're kind of rising above that. And
well, you've just put your finger on it, that you play yourself in a somewhat unsympathetic way. I mean, you're not the most sensitive person in the movie. You're very competitive. Even though your girlfriend has come with the baby that you had together to be with you, she's traveled 200 miles, you have an affair with someone else. It is not like the most sympathetic portrait. Of course, the movie's a comedy. But so are you not the kind of actor who'd say, that's not flattering, I don't want to do it?
No, I think the work I've done so far, I've played characters before that are not me, but I've used elements of me in the writing of those characters. And often if you're trying to make comedy, and subtle comedy that's kind of illuminating and interesting, you have to use elements of yourself that aren't sympathetic. But obviously when you're creating a character, you have a different name, and therefore you kind of distance yourself from it, and you're saying, this is a creation, it's not me. Whereas I'm playing a little game here. So I actually think that the work that attracts me is portraying characters, and this one happens to share my name, and as I've admitted, there are certain things within my personality that I've drawn upon when I improvise. You kind of give rent, maximize and articulate those parts of your personality that are unsympathetic, and the parts of my personality that I think are kind of well-adjusted and well-rounded, I kind of keep those in check and don't really show much of that, because it's actually dramatically less interesting and doesn't make for good comedy. Most comedy characters are not rational, well-rounded, well-adjusted human beings. So, if you like, you have to give free rein to those parts of yourself that are dysfunctional.
I've mostly seen you in comedies or, movies that had comic elements to them, like 24-Hour mm-hmm. Party People, Happy Endings that came out this summer, in which you played Lisa Kudrow's brother, the new film Tristram Shandy, and of course the TV work that you've done as Alan Partridge, the talk show host and radio DJ. Who are some of the comics and actors that inspired you when you were growing up?
There were people who inspired me, I think, in England. There were the usual people like Monty Python and Peter Sellers. American comics that influenced me were, I guess, the SNL people, all those people who emerged in the late 70s in America, the Belushis and Aykroyds. And I more recently, of course, I was hugely influenced by Rob Reiner in the film This Is Spinal Tap. That was a big influence for me.
Oh, sure, because you created a whole kind of like fake BBC talk show and a character named Alan Partridge. Can you talk about creating him and why you wanted to create this fake talk show host?
I wanted to create a character who represented all the things I found banal and inane in media commentary, because in the kind of lowbrow areas of the media, people try to condense things and compartmentalize them and turn them into it's a very reductive kind of medium. And also there's a lot of kind of vanity that exists within television. And it just seemed like a very ripe area of comedy that hadn't been explored so much. Larry Sanders came out in England soon after I was doing Alan Partridge, and that was often compared with that character. But it was just an area of comedy. You always, when you explore comedy, you always look for areas that you feel haven't been exploited. And that struck me as one of them. And you can hear it in any kind of daytime, talk show host on any cable channel, and often in sports commentators. The funniest thing I find is when a commentator has to fill in and say stuff to fill the gaps in the airtime rather than actually making serious commentary. So they end up having to just say words that don't mean anything. And I think that's the thing that made me think there was a lot of comedy there.
Oh, and it's a lot of fun as an interviewer myself watching you as Alan Partridge interview guests. On one edition of the show, you're interviewing a woman from Playboy magazine. And this is a great example of what happens when you don't read the book before you interview an author. let me play a clip of this. So this is you as Alan Partridge interviewing a woman author from Playboy magazine.
Daniela Forrest, you are Playboy's agony aunt. And you've also just published your autobiography.
Luck Be a Lady.
There it is. That's the book. There we go. It's your autobiography. It's published by Jones. Never heard of them. what comes across very strongly is your understanding of male psychology.
Well, I think I understand men because I adore them.
And what, as a woman, do you look for in a man?
Power is attractive. Mm-hmm. Sensitivity. Sense of humour. I like a man who knows who he is.
I'm Alan Partridge, carry on. Now, you also help people with their sexual problems. Let me give you a hypothetical problem. there's a couple, right? They've been married 15, 16 years, maybe more. And they've never slept, neither of them have ever slept with anyone else.
And he's frustrated?
Yes, deeply, deeply. But that's only part of the problem. The real problem is that their sex life is, well, for want of a better word, moribund.
People need to explore their sex lives if they're not working, you know. If it's not working in the bedroom, bring it into the living room or the kitchen.
Yeah, well they tried that, but the dog just wanted it. It was very awkward.
Some people, they find it very sexy to be watched.
Not by the dog, I mean...
Once again, here is a man shying away from discussing sex. When I was a man, I used to have the same problem, but as a woman, I find that I am liberated.
Well, I'm very pleased for you. Now, hang on a minute. Who was a man?
When I was a man.
What are you talking about?
Will you have read my book?
Yeah, yes. No, I never read the books.
Why did you invite me on your show?
I thought you were sexy. I don't now. You're a bloke. Have I got man to knock your block off?
That's Steve Coogan as Alan Partridge, and the series runs on BBC America. It must have really been fun to dress yourself as the character of Alan Partridge. You wear some horrible suits and sweaters in it. Would you describe one of your favorite costumes?
There's a certain way that businessmen who are used to wearing suits all the time try and dress when they have their weekend off or they're wearing casual clothes. And because they're not generally comfortable in casual clothes, they never look completely comfortable in them. And it's just kind of slacks that have a kind of an iron crease right down the middle and loafers that look like they're just straight off the shelf, and nothing's worn in or comfortable. It's all kind of crisp and kind of anally retentive in the way it's kind of put on. And there's a vague golfing theme to it as well. He calls it sports casual, but it's buttoned down, crisp, kind of non-faded super bright middle-aged men's clothes. I think we've all seen them.
Alan Partridge is the kind of person who always has opinions and gives his opinions with great confidence, although they're usually, you know, incredibly foolish. And I thought I'd play another clip, and this is from the radio version. After his talk show on TV fails, he becomes a radio DJ. And here's a clip from the opening episode of the Alan Partridge series as a radio DJ.
That was Big Yellow Taxi by Joni Mitchell, a song in which Joni complains that they paved Paradise to put up a parking lot, a measure which actually would have alleviated traffic congestion on the outskirts of Paradise, something which Joni singularly fails to point out, perhaps because it doesn't quite fit in with her blinkered view of the world. Nevertheless, nice song. It's 4:35 a.m. You're listening to Up with the Partridge.
That's my guest Steve Coogan as Alan Partridge. It must really be fun to play somebody who's so free with their opinions and makes such a fool of themselves when giving it.
It's great because, you know, I'll often, like most people, we may think things now and again which we oughtn't to think, but we don't say them out loud. We might have a thought and chastise ourselves about it and think, well, I thought that about that person, but I shouldn't really think that, and so I don't say it out loud because I know that's inappropriate. And so what Alan does is he doesn't have that normal editing checking process that most human beings have, so he says stuff he shouldn't say. And also is that kind of, there's a famous quote from Alexander Pope which says, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. And Alan has lots of a little knowledge, so he doesn't know a lot about anything. And that makes for good comedy, because you just talk, you speak first and think later.
My guest is Steve Coogan. He's starring in the new film Tristram Shandy, A Cock and Bull Story. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is British comic and actor Steve Coogan. He's starring in the new movie, Tristram Shandy, A Cock and Bull Story. Now, you've done a lot of impressions over the years. You got started, I think, on Spitting Image, which was a puppet satire of politics in England, and you did voices for that. Were you always good at impressions?
Yeah, I did. You know, I used to do lots of voices, and it was a way into the business. You know, it's very difficult these days to try and get on as an actor, very difficult. So you have to kind of do a quick trick, something to get someone's attention very quickly to be noticed. And impressions were one of those things. I used to do a lot of people like, you know, actors and politicians. I do
Roger Moore and speak like that in a very reserved kind of way. I do Sean Connery, who of course has that real deep Scottish brogue. And
I do people like Michael Caine, who are altogether slightly different, with a very, very slight Cockney sound to their voice.
My God, that's perfect. That was really perfect.
Well, thank you very much.
Has he heard you do that?
Michael Caine hasn't. Roger Moore has. In fact, I had Alan Partridge actually interviewed Roger Moore for real a couple of years ago for a homeless charity in London.
Oh, gosh.
He agreed to do it. He was a very good sport. He didn't mind Alan being ill-informed and wanting constantly to talk about James Bond, which is something that Roger Moore, I'm sure, has moved on from a long time ago. So he was a great sport about that, and he knew that I'd been one of the people who'd satirised him and poked fun at him on Spitting Image. But there's a very good kind of all the kind of the British may have their faults, but I think being able to laugh at themselves is one that they're quite good at.
It must be odd for you when you're playing a character in real life interviewing a real person. I mean, Roger Moore's part wasn't scripted, right?
Semi-scripted. I gave him some ripostes because I knew Alan was going to say unsympathetic things to him.
Like what?
And, I said something like, I said, do you think I said, as Alan. I said, do you think I'd
make a good spy, Roger?
I think he said something like,
No, to be a spy, you have to be subtle, well-observed, discreet, and intelligent.
And so, of course, you know, that didn't sit very well with Alan. So that was a lot of fun, yeah. And the character was quite popular in England. I did an interview with Elton John on this TV show, and that was great fun because I said to him beforehand, I said, do you mind if I'm quite rude to you as Alan? And he said, do your worst, you know. So I was pretty merciless with him, you know. I sort of talked about the fact that he was gay.
What did you say to him about being gay?
I said something like, you are a gay man. And you're allowed, you know, something about the kind of suit he was wearing. He was wearing a pink suit. And I talked about it being, you know, you wouldn't have worn that years ago. But after you, you know, came out, I can't remember what it was. Something about him coming out and, you know, wearing a pink suit and how I wouldn't wear something like that. And because Alan's slightly, I think, sort of very, ever so slightly, he's never very malicious, but there's just, he's ever, ever so slightly homophobic, which makes for good comedy, of course, especially when you're interviewing Elton John.
So how did you come up with the voice for Alan Partridge?
Well, you listen to lots of broadcasters on... I used to do lots of voiceovers, actually, on TV commercials. You know, the kind of, if you want a better deal from Ford, get down to blah, blah, blah today. It's only, you know...
did you really?
$48 a month and all that kind of, like, APR, 22%, blah, blah, blah. You know, I do all that kind of stuff, cramming in those inane, nasty, cheap, disposable radio commercials that we all try and avoid but seem to intrude into our lives every day. So I did a lot of that, and you get familiar with these kind of... Some broadcasters, you get the idea, seem probably love the sound of their own voice a bit too much. Those people who speak with a very deep, warm brown voice on radio shows where they talk in a very sort of subtle way like that, and you get the impression that they like the ups and downs of the timbre of their own voice. that kind of thing. You hear all that stuff. And there is there's certain people who, because they are thinking as they speak, will emphasize any word arbitrarily for no reason whatsoever. So there's no proper syntax to what they're saying. And you just think, why are they speaking like that? And it's, well, obviously, because they're not quite sure what they're saying. So there used to be, there's a certain fashion in Britain at the moment for Scottish and Welsh accents, but very, very subtly applied. So you'll often see an Irish also, which was used to be a real no-no, because, of course, 50 years ago, Irish were second-class citizens in England. But now that you'll hear... you'll often hear people on adverts with a very slight Irish accent like that, because it's seen as approachable and friendly and not distant, like a lot of British accents. And you'll hear the Scottish for the same reason, because, of course, they were oppressed by the English, so, of course, they can't be all bad. You know, so that's used a lot, because then it has that kind of slight anti-establishment vibe about it, which makes something appear less governmental, I think.
My guest is Steve Coogan. He's starring in the new film Tristram Shandy, A Cock and Bull Story. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
We'll be right back.
My guest is British comic and actor Steve Coogan. He's starring in the new movie Tristram Shandy, A Cock and Bull Story. When we left off, he was demonstrating some of the many voices and accents that he's done. Did you study voice, or did you just like pick all this up yourself?
I studied it a little bit. I went to drama school to study, and they teach you how to... Because I'm from the north, and of course, you know, you learn what they call received pronunciation, which has always made me laugh, which was stemmed from the way you were supposed to be received by royalty.
Is that what it means? You know, I've heard that expression. I've never understood what it meant.
Yeah, no, it's not receiving. It's the accent with which it was... You had an accent which was acceptable for you to be received by royalty, so that... Which, of course, is complete nonsense these days, because the way the royals speak is not, and no one else on earth speaks like that, I think. You know, the way they speak in sort of slightly upper class, before you can't quite do the same, it's all very dipped and sort of they didn't move the lips very much. It's a ridiculous way to speak. But what they generally mean these days is kind of like sort of BBC English, which is very sort of accentless, and I guess it's what you're kind of... CNN newscasters sound like would be the American equivalent. That was what they taught you to speak there, because, of course, I'm from Manchester, so I have a northern accent, a regional accent, which is what it was, quite pronounced.
So what were you supposed to fix in your speech?
Oh, well, I mean, for things like, you know, in your accent, you'd say things like, I'm going upstairs to have a bath, is how I would have said it in my original accent, whereas in actual fact, when you do receive pronunciation, then you have to say, I'm going to go upstairs to have a bath. So there's little subtle variations that you become aware of. And it's also very... Britain's quite class-ridden and very aware of class in a way that's not as prominent in America, although I think obviously class is a real issue. It's something that people are acutely aware of in Britain. So, and your accent says a lot about that. So... You can sort of, and people, whether they like it or not, do make judgments. Put it this way, if I'm on the phone complaining about something not being delivered on time, I use my poshest voice possible to intimidate the person on the other end. whereas if I'm trying to, if there's some kind of big, heavy guy who's being a bit threatening to me, I'll drop my H's and T's to sort of talk to him on his level so he doesn't think I'm some rarefied Poncy bloke.
Just one more question. Do you feel like when you're working in more or less your own voice, do you feel like you're almost working with your hands tied behind your back because you have this incredible gift for voices and you're just using your regular old voice in it?
Yes and no. Sometimes it's easier because it's more relaxing. It's like acting in your own clothes. If you wear your own clothes, you wear the clothes you're comfortable in. If I put on, as I have done for when I played a woman on stage once, if you put on things that are uncomfortable or you've got to dress up in things that are strange, then it's easier to be different, but it's easier to look more interesting. You know, if I put a hat on and lipstick and wear a corset and high heels, I'm certainly going to look slightly more interesting, if not particularly pleasant, than I look right now. And the same thing goes with your voice. If you put a voice on, it's kind of easy to get people's attention, but it's not so comfortable. You know, I spent so many years, you know, putting on silly voices and wearing wigs and moustaches and beards and things that irritate your face, that getting a chance to wear my own clothes and speak in my own voice was like a kind of holiday.
Steve Coogan, a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Steve Coogan is starring in the new movie Tristram Shandy, A Cock and Bull Story. It will open gradually in theaters around the country starting at the end of the month. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a song from the new CD by jazz singer Susie Arioli and guitarist Jordan Officer. The CD includes several country songs by Roger Miller. This is one of them.
I got up and made my morning cup of coffee, fooled around the the house an hour more, I guess. I did all this before I even had one thought of you. 'Cause more and more I think about you, less and less. I'm surprised, but after all, it's been a while now since I lost your love and all my happiness. It looks as though I just might maybe learn to smile again. 'Cause more and more I think about you, less and less. I wouldn't be surprised if any day now all these teardrops I've been crying, all these heartaches you caused me, began to wither in and die. And just now someone asked me if I'm hearing from you, and I felt a lot like crying, I'll confess. But I didn't cry, I guess the worst is over now. 'Cause more and more I think about you, less and less.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Lighting Up, How I Stopped Smoking, Drinking, and Everything Else I Loved in Life Except Sex, by journalist Susan Shapiro. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life, online at pewtrusts.org. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD available at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the musical world of singer-songwriter and producer Joe Henry. His new CD, I Believe to My Soul, features Ann Peebles, Irma Thomas, and Alan Toussaint. One of his own songs became a hit for his sister-in-law, Madonna, and there's the story of his song about Richard Pryor. Join us for the next Fresh Air.